Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts here in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. I'll be talking today with actors Lindy Moe and Xavier McKinnon, who play Maureen and Benny in the 20th anniversary tour of the musical Rent, closing this Sunday at the SHN Golden Gate Theater. Get your tickets now. From the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, I'll talk with music director Ming Luke and assistant conductor Julia Morris about the ensemble's performances of A German Requiem by Johannes Brahms this weekend, along with Brahms' Tragic Overture on the program, a warm-up for the ensemble's grand tour of Europe through Baltic states and Sweden coming up in shortly. I'll also talk with Peter Stein, senior programmer for Frameline 43, getting underway tonight. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, talks with theater professor and artistic director of the Stanford Repertory Theater, Rush Rame, about the company's 21st annual summer festival, focusing on environment and social justice. Stay with us. Be in pictures, indeed, or at least you ought to be going to the pictures over these next 10 days, as Frameline 43, the world's foremost, largest, and longest-running LGBTQ plus film festival, gets underway tonight, with the opening film and gala, the film being Vita and Virginia, which brings to life the dazzling erotic story of one of the great lesbian love affairs of the 20th century, that of Virginia Woolf and Vita Sackville West. And before it's all over on the 30th, some 174 films from 38 countries will be screened for Bay Area audiences here and in Berklee. Here to talk about this, I'm very pleased to welcome back Peter Stein, senior programmer for Frameline. As a producer, programmer, and presenter, Peter's career spans film, theater, television, museums, and online media. He was a longtime executive director of the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival, the first and largest of its kind. In addition, he spent over a decade over at KQED on the TV side of things, where he wrote, directed, and produced documentaries and series, and garnered a Peabody for his full-length feature, The Castro. Peter, welcome back to Open Air.
It's great to see you, David, and happy to share some tidbits about the upcoming Frameline Festival.
Oh, my gosh. How long have you been now at Frameline?
This is my sixth year as senior programmer, and the films just keep getting better and better, and the choices get harder and harder. I think we looked at something like 1,400 submissions and other films that we considered from other festivals and that have been in the pipeline for a while to come down to our final selection.
Right. Well, let's talk about that. First of all, I'm in denial that it's already Frameline time.
I know, and this is late for us. Usually we're already up this week, but because Pride is the last possible day it can be on in June, we're actually opening here right at the end of June. But yes, I hope we see you lots around the festival.
Well, my dance card is looking pretty full, just looking through the schedule, so I'm sure you'll see me out and about. Well, let's first talk about these bookend screenings that open and close the festival. Tell us more about Vita and Virginia and how it garnered the prime opening slot of the festival.
Oh, it's just a lavish, a well-told tale. If you're a fan of The Crown or Downton Abbey, you get the kind of luster that this film brings. It's a period piece set in the 20s, this great love story between Virginia Woolf and Vita Sackville West. As much as I want to pump it up, I do have to say that it runs tonight, and it's sold out, although there are rush tickets that are going to be available. If folks want to come down to the Castro about 6 o'clock, the rush line will be starting. But it was a natural for us. First of all, we love being able to showcase women's stories, women's films. Sometimes people think of quote-unquote gay film festivals and presume it's mainly the gay men who are coming. And no, no, no. We have a tremendous amount of women's stories, trans stories, non-binary stories throughout the festival. We wanted to close with Gay Chorus Deep South. That's the film that we're ending the festival with on June 30th, because it's a local story about our own wonderful San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus and their remarkable tour down to the South to bring music and, they hope, some understanding.
I was going to say, just last week I spoke with Tim Selig, director of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, about their concerts and also about their plum placement in the final slot.
Yes.
A very timely portrait of the times we're living in.
Exactly. And that's what we look for in the festival, is to have a nice variety of films that are kind of timeless, as well as those that really speak to the current moment. We have a small kind of unacknowledged sidebar this year on LGBTQ immigration and asylum seeking. It's, you know, we still are living in an era when countries around the world and regimes and societies are still deeply, deeply homophobic and transphobic. It's illegal to be gay in many countries. And there's a beautiful film made locally here called Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in the U.S., that is about four asylum seekers from Syria, from Congo, from Angola, people who've come to the Bay Area to try to find asylum. And this is an ongoing issue now in the U.S. What kind of sanctuary are we? What kind of safe haven can we be providing in the current climate? And so that's a film, a documentary that kind of, it didn't come out of nowhere. We've known it's been in production for a while, but we're just so moved that we can show it here in the Bay Area with the subjects in present. That's going to be on Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm. Again, it's called Unsettled. And we're following it with a panel with some subjects from other films that we're showing this weekend as well that deal with LGBTQ immigration.
Right. Well, Frameline has always been a important focus and shining a light on world cinema and things that you would not hear about otherwise. Especially timely, I should mention as well, given the news of the day, will be the screening this Saturday at 1 at the Victoria Theater of Tehran, City of Love.
Oh my gosh, to find a film that in its own coded way is a gay film, a queer film coming from Iran, is first of all just kind of stunning. And it's also one of the most wonderful black comedies that you could ever find, gay or otherwise. I'm amazed that it got by the censors. It's a triptych of stories. One of which is just very clearly not just coded. It's a gay storyline, and it's about three people who are sort of misfits, and they're unlucky in love, and it follows each of them, and some of them overlap, and it's just got a wickedly black sense of humor. Quite wonderful. This year, we were just thrilled to show films not just from Iran. We have two films from China. One called Mei Li, which is a very dark lesbian, young lesbian love story. We've got a film from Romania called Monsters, one of the best dramas in the festival, I think. And a film from Vietnam, one of my kind of sleeper favorites called Song Lang. A beautiful kind of noirish film, very moody and atmospheric, set in 1980s Saigon, which is the unlikely relationship or friendship that develops between a very tough kind of gangster guy and this folk opera singer that he starts to become almost obsessed with. And the cast is going to be here from Vietnam. The director, who's Vietnamese-American, is coming. Again, that one's called Song Lang.
Mm,
and
wow.
That plays, I think, on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. Also an important focus of Frameline is the emphasis on documentary. And the centerpiece documentary being something I think everyone would be anxious to see, Sid and Judy.
Yes, this is the world premiere of a film about Judy Garland. And before everybody in the audience collectively kind of rolls their eyes, say, we know everything about Judy Garland. I thought I knew everything about Judy Garland. But in fact, here's a new film that sheds some new light on her, particularly the struggles that she faced after she was kind of booted off the MGM studio lot and started to have to create, in a way, a new identity for herself as a concert. As a concert performer, as a singer, not just in the movies. And it's told through her own voice as well as through the memoirs of Sid Luft, who was her third husband, father of two of her children. And his memoirs only recently were published posthumously. And it is just a marvelous insight into what it took to be Judy Garland in all of that, all of the ups and downs. It reminds you what an extraordinary, unique talent she was, and is particularly appropriate this June. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of her passing, and this is a new way to appreciate who
and
she was.
The whole riots of Stonewall have to do with, to a certain degree, with Judy.
Yeah, well, some who would like to say that, you know, the Queens were rioting because Judy had died. I'm not sure that really is historically accurate.
They were attacked in Stonewall at a time when they were mourning Judy.
Right.
Part of the storyline there.
We've had enough, exactly. So Sid and Judy, it's a world premiere. It'll be on Wednesday night at the Castro Theater.
While we're on Hollywood, another documentary that I'm almost through with. I'm just about through with the preview screening of Making Montgomery Clift, made by one of his nephews, Robert Anderson Clift. Now, apparently this guy's father, Brooks Clift, which was Monty's brother, was keeper of the flame, so to speak, and possesses an amazing archive of not only audio recordings, but just everyday conversations, the usual press clippings, film reels, but so much more, and has been key to transforming the Hollywood narrative of Montgomery Clift being this tortured homosexual that ended up having a tragedy. In fact, he was quite happy with his life for a good part.
Right. That's the discovery that this film allows us to have, is to see Montgomery Clift as a fully rounded person, not just only with this downward arc of his life and the tragic car accident and the early death. And all of that is there. It's in the film and it's true to his story. But you get a much more rounded and sometimes quite jovial and delightful picture of who Montgomery Clift was. And that's what happens when you get somebody with tremendous access, like his nephew, with this incredible trove of archive paired with good filmmaking skills. And he had a co-director in this, Hilary Denman. And the two of them will be here at the Castro on Sunday. And it's just, again, one of those discovery films where you say, I thought I knew the basic story of who this person was, whether it's Montgomery Clift or Judy Garland or Virginia Woolf. And films allow us to go in a completely new discovery direction.
Mm-hmm. Highlights, of course, of the Frameline Festival are the Fun and Boys shorts and the Fun and Girls shorts.
Yes.
Those must be the most challenging to select for.
To be honest, they are, because comedy is, first of all, it's subjective. So what I'm laughing at in a film may not be what you laugh at, David, although I have a feeling we share a sense of humor. But also...
And we're friends of Dorothy.
Yeah. with Fun and Boys and Fun and Girls, these are now institutions at Frameline. People often buy their tickets to those programs without even knowing what the films are, because they just want to go to the theater and have a good time. And particularly in times like these where the news is rough and life isn't always so easy, we really do occasionally want to provide simply an escape, a jolly time. And I think in the case of Fun and Boys in particular, which I curated this year, or co-curated with my colleague Paul Struthers, we just wanted to make sure that people could laugh. They could also shed a bit of a tear, because some of the films are actually kind of poignant, but they're lighthearted and they're a lot of fun. We show that one twice. Fun and Girl shorts we also show twice, once at the Castro this weekend, and then once in our biggest East Bay location at the Piedmont in Oakland.
And we should give a plug for Worldly Affairs as well, which has the shorter films but on an international focus.
Yes, we look for revealing, interesting, sometimes sexy stories coming from all over the world. We have fascinating films from France in that program, from Hong Kong. Again, that's kind of a signature program. And the shorts are just revelations to us sometimes. We have also a very strong section this year of episodic programs. That is, films that were made not necessarily to be shown on the big screen, but to be shown on streaming platforms or as webisodes. But there's such strong content, particularly in trans and non-binary work, films centering on queer folks of color, that we have a whole section of episodics. And they're terrific.
Well, you know, I'm looking at a whole section of shorts now. It's not just those other categories. We have a whole section on transtastic.
Exactly. Transgender content film. We have a tribute program in the shorts section this year to Marlon Riggs. We are honoring the 25th anniversary of his passing. He was, of course, a groundbreaking, pioneering African-American filmmaker, documentary maker based here in the Bay Area. So we're doing a 25th anniversary showing of his little scene short films.
And the animated shorts. Tell us a little bit about how those were selected.
Oh, that. Well, we don't always get enough of a selection of animated films to create a whole program. But this year we do. We have a remarkable 45-minute, it's sort of the anchor piece of it, called Top 3, which is from Sweden. And there's also some very brief. I think the shortest film in our festival might be this 2-minute goof, a sort of animation hysterical film called Docking. I think it might be only 2 or 3 minutes long.
Four minutes.
It still might be the shortest film in the festival. What's nice is when we see films that showcase the craft, filmmaking craft from all over the world. It could be in animation form. We have a virtual reality program this year for the first time, free of charge, at the De Young Museum on Saturday, a whole afternoon of virtual reality short films that are also transgender in content.
Hmm. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll take a friend to one of these amazing films that will be happening between now and the 30th. And speaking on a lighter note, let's go out with some music from Kinky Boots, shall we? Tell us how that got in the festival.
Oh, we're so excited. We're going to be the world premiere of something that we've never done at Frameline before, which is to have not so much a movie but a live-captured HD cinema experience of the London West End cast of Kinky Boots, the Cyndi Lauper, Harvey Fierstein musical. And we've never done this before, so we're hoping that the theater fans out there will come and join up with the film festival fans and come to Kinky Boots on Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock.
Nice. Peter Stein, thanks so much for coming in. As always, information at frameline.org for everything that's going on in this festival and the year-round work that Frameline does.
Thank you, David.
Future of Price and Son.
Oh, Papa's got a brand new shoe. A life of broken heels got you down.
Well, we've got your solution.
Get up,
get it on, and get in step with our kinky revolution. Let me hear you say yeah, yeah. Welcome to our future. No longer are we making shoes. We are making 2.5 feet of irresistible tubular sex. So let's do it!
I punch the holes.
I sew the seams. And I pull the leather tie.
I put the steel inside the heel.
Kinky Boots, the musical, being screened this Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Castro, directed by Jerry Mitchell and Brett Sullivan. Broadway babies and footwear fans will rejoice. Kinky Boots, the musical, Harvey Fierstein's amazing work on that film. And the Broadway production of it, too. It's just frameline.org for more information. And now for something completely different, as they say, as we move to the world of classical music in the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra. As you've been hearing on KLW, we're a media sponsor for the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, which is presenting Brahms' German Requiem here in Berklee on the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd under the baton of Maestro Ming Luke and his assistant, Julia Morse. Ming Luke is director of the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, only the third director in its more than 50-year history. He's wielded his baton locally at the San Francisco Ballet as principal guest conductor there, has written, arranged, and performed over 120 educational concerts with the Berklee Symphony, for whom he is associate conductor. Also music director of the Merced Symphony, has international credits that continue to accumulate. Ming, always a pleasure to welcome you back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And he's joined by Julia Morse, assistant conductor for the BCCO, who is also a vocalist and flutist here in the Bay Area, a Bay Area native. Julie is an inaugural member of the conducting staff for National Children's Chorus's recently established San Francisco chapter, where she teaches and conducts the debut ensemble. Julie will be wielding the baton for Brahms' A Tragic Overture that's part of the program. Julia, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Of course. Let's start with the massive work that is the German Requiem, Ming. Choosing this to go on tour in Europe, that's a bold statement, I think.
I think one of our favorite things about touring is collaborating with the ensembles in Europe, and we're going to be collaborating with three different orchestras while we're there. And, you know, because music is obviously universal and the Brahms German Requiem is such a famous work, there are many choruses and orchestras that perform this. And so we'll be collaborating with a few choruses while we're there in different cities in the Baltics, and, as I mentioned, three different orchestras as well.
Taking you to Helsinki, Tallinn in Estonia, Riga in Latvia, and Stockholm as well. How is the itinerary determined then? And are these halls that you're familiar with, or are they going to be new for you?
All completely new, both the countries as well as the performing halls and the ensembles as well. It's going to be a whirlwind trip because I think it's only around 11 days or so. And we're going to be in four different cities performing with three different orchestras and I think six different choruses that we're collaborating with along the way. BCCO has gone on tour before, but to Eastern Europe, to Prague, to Vienna, and to various other areas. And this is an area that we know has a deep tradition in choral music, especially Estonia. And so we wanted to make connections. And as I mentioned, the greatest part, I think, about traveling with music is connecting with others, especially for pieces that are as rich and deep as the Brahms Requiem.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little bit about the Requiem itself, which, you know, many composers have set the Requiem for the Dead to music, composers too numerous to mention, but Brahms really turned that whole format on its head to a certain, to a great degree, in that he, instead of making it a mass for the dead, it was more for the living, to offer comfort to the living.
Exactly. You know, Brahms was in Vienna when he heard that his mother was very, very ill, and so he tried to get back to Hamburg as quickly as he could, but he didn't make it in time. But when he did arrive, he saw his sister completely distraught, who was there. And I think that is really sort of the genesis of that work being for the living, to comfort the living. You know, it says, the very first words are, "Blessed are those who bear suffering." And it's only until the very end of the work, the seventh movement, where it says, "Blessed are those that have died." And so, you know, the fourth movement is how beautiful is how lovely is thy dwelling place, is one of the most gorgeous pieces in the entire repertory. And the fifth movement is one of my favorites, is almost like it's an ode directly to his mother. Mm-hmm. You know, the last words almost sound like Auf Wiedersehen, and it's the last movement that he wrote. He actually only had six movements beforehand, but he included that fifth movement to give it a nice architectural structure, the seven movements with that fourth movement, How Lovely Is Thy Dwelling Place, mm-hmm. as the keystone.
And the whole work was rolled out over a series of performances. It wasn't all intact when it was first heard.
Yeah, the first three movements originally premiered, and it was considered to be not a success because apparently the timpani, as Laura says, misread the dynamic marking. Instead of pianissimo, he played fortissimo the entire time. And it's this huge fugue where he's literally playing a role for the entire movement, essentially.
Wouldn't that where the conductor would,
Exactly. You'd hope something would happen. But Brahms was actually deeply affected by it. And he mentions it many times in his memoirs that, you know, he thought that the first performance was really a failure. But the next performance had six movements. And then, as I mentioned, the last performance, which is the form that we find it today, is the seven movements, which are really beautifully structured. The first and seventh movements are connected, starting with those words, Selig sind, blessed are. The second and sixth movements, the third and fifth movements, and then, of course, the fourth movement, standing alone, is this beautiful waltz, How Lovely Is Thy Dwelling Place.
Mm, nice. We'll hear a little bit of that shortly to go out with, but let's talk with Julia a little bit about the accompanying work on this program, The Tragic Overture. Julia, sure. I'm not that familiar with... I'm familiar with the what we should say, a companion overture, the academic festival, mm-hmm. more than the tragic. Tell us a little bit about The Tragic Overture.
Well, it's a great... the Academic Festival Overture and the Tragic Overture are presented as a pair. So Brahms wrote them both at the same time to be presented and performed together. And so while the Academic Festival Overture is full of pop and circumstance and very happy, the Tragic Overture is very tempestuous and ominous. And there's a lot of great motivic material that Brahms introduces in the first just two or three phrases that he then kind of
develops.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Throughout the rest of the overture, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And is this your first opportunity to go on a tour with such a massive, big work as
this? It is. I'm very excited.
And tell us a little bit more about the makeup of the community chorus and how people can get involved as a singer and maybe go on a future tour with you.
I think
how often do the tours happen, by the way?
The international tours happen every 3 years, and the chorus tries to collaborate with as many ensembles in the Bay Area. So they've actually performed with my Merced Symphony. They've collaborated with, you know, for instance, Derek Tam, one of our former sing conductors, has put together his own performances of the German Requiem, as well as other collaborations. And so BCCO really tries to get into the community as much as possible. But that word community, you know, oftentimes is seen as disparaging. You know, we say the community ensembles are, let's say, lesser quality or technical abilities. And the board had this long debate about this, and we decided to really embrace that because the BCCO wants to be obviously integrated in the community, but also represent the community on full. So the tagline for BCCO generally is that music should be available for all, which is almost every single ensemble's tagline, right, and mission. But we take it to a different level where we, not only the concerts are free, but we feel that every single person amongst us has an artistic voice and should be able to sing and participate and use that artistic voice. If you've been singing with the San Francisco Symphony Chorus for 20 years, fantastic. We would love to have you. If you've never sung before and you can't match pitch, we would love to have you too, because everybody, again, is an artistic being and deserves to have the opportunity to perform. Now, that being said, we have 230 members in the chorus, and we have so many tools available to help people at every technical level. So if people have difficulty matching pitch, it's almost impossible to be tone deaf. Only 0.0001% of the, you know, people think that they might be tone deaf, but in reality, they just need a little bit more support to figure out how to use their voice to match pitch. We have lots of tools. We have lots of tools to help people with the pronunciation of the German, or for instance, we did Dvorak in Czech, and so that's not a very familiar language.
I was tremendously impressed by that.
And a lot of tools to really help with the pronunciation. And so at whatever level, even if you've been with the San Francisco Symphony Chorus for 20 years, we still have tools available to try to help you grow within the ensemble. And so, you know, the conductor program for Julia is part of, is actually part of that same thing too. Conductors, it's very, very difficult to get experience, because in order to get a job, you have to have experience. But in order to get experience, you have to have a job. Mm-hmm. And so BCCO often tries to give those opportunities as well. So having Julia here as one of our conducting staff, she has a lot of opportunities to conduct as well as on tour for the first time, which is absolutely fantastic. It's going to be a different experience working with all these different ensembles.
Mm, nice, Julia. And have you visited any of these cities that you're about to visit?
I have not. It'll be a first.
It'll be a whirlwind for you as
it
well.
It will, yeah.
The concerts of the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra prior to their big tour of Europe, the 21st at 8 p.m., the 22nd at 3 p.m., and the 23rd at 3 p.m. at Hertz Hall on the UC Berklee campus, bcco.org for more information. Ming, what's coming up for the fall repertoire?
The fall repertoire, you know, it's interesting. I actually don't remember what's on the fall repertoire because we just did our next 2 years of repertoire all together. And so it's fascinating to me because we had a music selection committee, and when I first joined BCCO, they said the music selection committee is 25 people in it. And I said, that's ludicrous. We're never going to get anything done. And it ended up being one of my most favorite experiences because it ended up being a discussion about what pieces made us were influential for us in the past. And it's not that we chose those pieces, but it became almost like a cathartic discussion about why music is important, what type of things affect us. And it's really interesting that out of those meetings, we ended up with repertoire for the next 2 years that spans from early, we have Haydn and Mozart, to new, we have Tippett, a child of our time. We have incredible works that are very familiar. We have works that are very unfamiliar, but are fantastic works. I think it's going to be a wonderful season, but I believe we're starting with the Haydn.
Yeah, the Mozart and the Haydn.
The Mozart Coronation Mass and the Haydn Lord Nelson Mass.
Nice. Well, we'll look forward to hearing about those and about everything else this very busy conductor does. And Julia Morris, thanks for coming in as well. I wish you a wonderful tour. Ming will talk to you again soon. But before you go, tell us a little bit about that fourth beautiful movement of a German Requiem of Brahms that we'll go out with to either familiarize or refamiliarize our audience with it.
Sure. You know, as I mentioned, as one can obviously assume, a Requiem can also have a lot of dark feelings and emotions. And the fourth movement is a respite from that. How lovely is thy dwelling place? It's this waltz. And the most striking thing about Brahms oftentimes is how beautiful his phrases are, how long they are, how legato they are, how moving they are. And this movement really symbolizes all of that and is, again, the centerpiece for the seven-movement grand work, the German Requiem.
Ming Luke, Julia Morris, thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Music of Johannes Brahms to go out with here. from Johannes Brahms' A German Requiem, How Lovely Is Thy Dwelling Place, the fourth movement of that amazing seven-movement work. Again, the concerts for the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra this weekend, bcco.org, under the direction of Julia Morris, assistant conductor, and Ming Lu, conductor, prior to their European tour of all kinds of wonderful places in Sweden, as well as Estonia and Latvia. bcco.org for more information. Still to come, Peter Robinson will be talking with professor and artistic director of the Stanford Repertory Theater about their annual summer festival, Environment and Social Justice. Let's go back to the world of musical theater for a moment. Seasons of Love from Rent. There are far less than 525,600 minutes to catch the 20th anniversary national touring production of Jonathan Larson's Rent. Final performance this Sunday at the Golden Gate Theater. I'm not going to do the math for how many minutes that is. In Rent, a bunch of bohemians are upset when the building they've squatted in has been taken over by a new owner, Benny, who plans to evict them and build a new space for artists. Of course, what's really crazy about all that is that the new owner used to be one of the squatters himself before marrying off to a rich Westchester County girl. He thinks he's helping them, but in reality, they're losing their home to gentrification and facing the fact that their beloved East Village is no longer a welcoming haven for artists. 20 years ago, Jonathan Larson brought Rent to the Great White Way. That mean landlord is one of my guests, the young New York City-based actor Xavier McKinnon, who plays Benny. He's joined in studio by Lindy Moe, who plays Maureen. She's been working on her musical theater chops in productions as diverse as Spamalot, The Addams Family, Les Mis, and American Idiot, but this is actually her first professional job. Welcome, Lindy Moe and Xavier McKinnon.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Yeah, sure. Xavier, your ears lit up a little bit when we played that earlier excerpt from Kinky Boots.
Yes, yes. I did the second national tour of Kinky Boots. I was one of the the referee angel. That was a blast, an absolute blast. I was lucky enough to touch that stage.
Nice. And so you're a veteran already of the national tour. Lindy Moe, this is a new experience for you.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I went from high school to college to this right off the bat, so it's been incredible. It's been very different from anything I've ever experienced before, but I wouldn't change anything.
And she does it like a pro.
Well, you got some good people you're learning from, too,
yes,
which is key.
Yes, I do.
So tell us a little bit about the what's it like to be on this national tour? Where have you been? Where are you going? When is it all over?
Funny you should mention that. We're actually, this year ends in about 3 weeks. All of our contracts are up. So it's getting to that point where when we sing the show, we get a little sad at points. And but this whole experience really has been just absolutely incredible. Going to different cities, meeting the people, trying like food or staple places in each city has just, it's just been incredible having this opportunity to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Favorite cities for either of you for visiting? San Francisco, of course.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Actually,
it's been great. It's anywhere we get to go for like a week or two. is just great because we get a chance to really experience the culture. We get a chance to live kind of normal lives. We get to maybe cook for ourselves. We get to go to a Barnes & Noble. We get to get to do things that you can't do when you're just in a place for 1 week or two. I really liked Norfolk, Virginia. It was such a cool place to be. Even though we weren't there for that long, it was just awesome. It was really, really
awesome.
That's
what's nice about it. I mean, you discover these places where you may not have even thought of going.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So tell us a little bit about the show itself. I just gave an encapsulation. Tell us a little bit more about your character, Maureen, what she goes through.
So my character, Maureen Johnson, is a performance artist, and she's actually dating a woman, Joanne Jefferson, and throughout the show, we see their relationship, and we see the ups and downs, but we see that through the end of it all, they love each other, and that's the most important thing. So what Maureen does is she's not the biggest fan of Benny, not the biggest fan of Benny. She puts on this one-night performance, and it's basically this giant metaphor about how she wants to save the lot where homeless people gather and where everybody, it's sort of a safe haven, as you said. What Benny is trying to turn it into this cyber studio, which is gentrification, and trying to just turn it into something that she does not stand for, which all of the friends, they don't stand for. So she's trying to stop that, bite that in the bud, and he is just not there for it. He wants to keep pushing through. Uh-huh.
Well, Benny, you have a different vision, shall we say?
Yes, yeah.
And let's think about this as a musical 20 years ago. Also very prominent to the storyline is the AIDS epidemic. Mm-hmm. And so how does that work into the plot and the characters of the show?
Well, a couple of the main characters have HIV and AIDS. And so the way that HIV and AIDS has worked into the story is it's very important in that time, the late 80s, early 90s. Not only are we dealing with the homeless in the city, but we're dealing with HIV and AIDS and the uncertainty of your life. So as an audience member, you're watching the show, and you not only feel for these people who are homeless, but you feel for these people who are uncertain if they have a tomorrow, which is why we sing 525,600 minutes, because life is not only to be measured in minutes, it's meant to be measured in love, it's meant to be measured in cups of coffee, it's meant to be measured in friendships. And so it's really, really, really important that HIV and AIDS is brought up, because it was really important in the late 80s, early 90s, because we just didn't know what it was.
Right, and as young actors now, you must have a completely different perspective about HIV.
Absolutely. It's so incredible. It's absolutely incredible what we're lucky enough to touch and tell the story of today, because it's 2019 and HIV, you know, we have PrEP and we've got HIV is no longer a death sentence. Yeah. Whereas back then it was. You really weren't sure if you were gonna make it. And it allows these characters to be so much more human too, because they're all kind of rough around the edges. But where you relate to them all is they're all so sensitive to life. They're all very sensitive. Even Benny, when some deaths happen in the story, I feel like that's what helps Benny become more human. And he's like, oh, wait, these are my friends, and we're dealing with life and death. And it's an important aspect of the story, and it's an important aspect of the time. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Pulitzer and Tony Award-winning production. It really is a masterpiece. If you're not familiar with Rent, think of Puccini's La Bohème. It's an imaginative reimagining of that story, and follows an unforgettable year in the lives of these seven young people, young artists struggling to follow their dreams without selling out. Inspiring messages of joy and hope in the face of fear, and it really is a timeless celebration of friendship and creativity that reminds us that our lives are the only thing that matters is love.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
We wish you love in the rest of this tour and many more to come. Lindy Moe, I hope that includes many more tours for you of all kinds of productions
in
your young life. And Xavier McKinnon, I hope New York continues to thrive in your personal career.
Thank you.
And come back and see us when you're back in town.
Absolutely.
Rent runs through Sunday, only a few more minutes, a couple thousand minutes, I guess. I haven't done the math. To catch Rent at the Golden Gate Theater, shnsf.org. www.lavieboheme.com for more information. A little bit more music from Rhett here. La Vie Boheme.
Today I wake to make a living. Masochism, pain, perfection, muscle spasms, chiropractic, short girls, eating disorder.
Adventure, tedium, no family, boring locations, dark rooms, perfect faces, egos, money, Hollywood, and sleep.
Food of love, emotion, mathematics, isolation, rhythm, power, feeling, harmony, and heavy competition.
Anarchy,
revolution, justice, screaming for solutions, forcing changes, risking danger, making noise and making green.
Faggots, lesbians, dykes, cross-dressers,
La Vie Boheme from Rent, the 20th anniversary production at the Golden Gate Theater through Sunday. SHNSF.com for more information. We move to the Theater of Stanford now with Peter Robinson and his guest. Peter.
Hi, David. Yes, good to be here. And also good to welcome Rush Rehm back to KLW. He is the director of the Stanford Repertory Theater, also a classics professor at Stanford. And I've got to say, Rush, just looking at your program, which kicks off on July the 11th, you have three plays coming up, and I know they are related to the environment and social justice program, but they really cover a wide realm of everything. So perhaps we should start with Voices of the Earth, subtitled From Sophocles to Rachel Carson and Beyond. And let's see what we're going to hear in this particular production, Rush.
Yes, this is a compilation that I worked on with Charles Junkerman of basically great environmental writing. It covers an enormous chronological period, basically from Hesiod to now, but also various themes built around the environment and social justice. Issues about what nature is, what is its relationship to human beings, what about the creation, what about animals, what about the sky and the sea, political, environmental activism, and what lies ahead. And so those voices are really, I must say, the writing is exceptional because it's basically, you know, gathered together from some of the best poets, some of the most powerful prose environmental writers. Poets include Pablo Neruda, Mary Oliver, Audre Lorde, Margaret Walker, W.S. Merwin, Robert Frost, Gary Snyder, some of the prose writers, Wallace Stegner, Gary Snyder again, and some prose.
Yeah, so this really is a wide range, and there are seven different actors, and they're going to be reading selective passages from these various poets and writers. So do they move from theme to theme? How does the story work?
Right, and although it's set up as a stage reading, they won't be reading. They know their lines. But the idea is that we're not trying to turn it into a play.
Right.
The way these assembling these readings is not just gathering great things, it's trying to put them into some sort of dialogue one with the other. So I'll give you a quick example. Empedocles says that the sea is the earth's sweat. Aristotle responds that doesn't tell us anything about the real world. And Rachel Carson responds by saying, I cannot talk about the sea if I don't use poetry. So you get an idea about the way in which these things are put together. We have, I think, eight sections that organize the material, so it's not random at all. And it does end with very much now. I mean, the last three sections are economists and politicians on the environment, and they're not all pro-environment. Some of these voices are pretty awful, and they're present. And they don't start just with the current administration. We go back to Reagan and Bush, and it's a remarkable history of neglect, I have to say. And then we move to environmental activists, ending primarily with the wonderful Bill McKibben and his book Falter. And then the very last section is what's left and what's left to be done, and that is a kind of call to action.
Now, this is taking place at the Nitri Theater, which is actually on campus down there at Stanford, And how do they use the stage to get across the stories that you're telling?
Well, in the case of a stage reading, it's relatively simple. The format is a kind of convention that you have music stands, but the fun part is when you leave them. And there are various ways in which we stage them. So it's actually a bit of a very interesting path of movement in it. But it is not meant to be a kind of the idea that it is not a play of people talking to one another in a room. It is more people talking amongst one another for an audience.
Mm-hmm. And the play runs, I'm using the word play in the pejorative sense, it runs from July the 11th to July the 14th.
Yes,
so it's actually a short run.
Very short run of this piece, and the theater only holds about 85 people, so my encouragement will be to get your tickets soon, and I think, Peter, you will tell us later where we can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we move on to the second. That's why I say it's a very busy season over a very condensed period of time. And this has an unusual title, Polar Bears, Black Boys, and Prairie-Fringed Orchids. And how do we bring all this together? That's my question.
Well, the play is a new play. It's never been actually performed before, although it had a reading, I think, at a playground recently by Vincent Terrell Durham. He's a Los Angeles playwright. He actually got his start in stand-up comedy, African-American comic now playwright, who started with Arsenio Hall, as it turns out. So the play is about the kind of collision, if you will, or the happy meeting turning into a collision between environmental activists, white gentrified family living in Harlem, with Black Lives Matter group. And of what you can imagine where this might go, very, very cleverly, very, very, with a great deal of humor, but ultimately leading to some pretty strong differences of opinion about what constitutes endangered species, how we deal with the threat to African Americans from the police and society at large, if one may say that, certainly the current administration, and where are well-meaning liberals on the spectrum. And so it's a really quite clever, wonderful play. And I have to say, having now worked on it for about a week with the actors, it never diminishes itself into a set of ideological claims that we are simply meant to line up with. We are left with a kind of debate.
And the setting is in an apartment in Harlem. Is that correct?
Yeah, a gentrified apartment in Harlem. The newcomers call it Soha, which is now the new version of Soho. And of course, the African Americans who have been living in Harlem don't like that sobriquet. So they we just call it Harlem. So you get already the way in which the disagreements arise.
And the liberal couple at the center of the action, they have adopted a black son, is that correct?
Yes, yeah. They have a three-year-old son they adopted when he was, I think, 3 weeks old, and so they're very interested in Black Lives Matter and the whole issue of what it would be like to raise an African-American child in America. And that is part of the way the play doesn't make this combination of people seem odd. It actually is an effort to understand the milieu that faces them, and this includes, of course, the future notion of extinction of species, and as we all know, the environmental crisis that is racing at us faster than we can talk.
So I've got the hang of polar bears. I understand black boys. Now, where does the prairie-fringed orchids come into this story?
Well, you have to have a flower in there. Now, one of the many causes that Molly Castle, the wife of the white woman activist, is involved in is trying to save a rare flower called the prairie-fringed orchid. In fact, it's a real flower, and it is threatened with extinction, and she has worked with a group of people to try to save a bunch of farmland in Oklahoma from being plowed under that would kill off this flower. And so that just pops up in the context of the evening, and that leads to all sorts of discussions about.
And out of interest, was that last story, or the one to do with the orchids, was that actually based on a real background piece?
Well, I don't know the history of it, but it is certainly the case that is an endangered plant.
Right.
And of course, you put endangered plants up with a bunch of other endangered things, and you're trying to think, where should you put your energy? But as we know, we put in the newspaper, a million species are threatened with extinction in the next 10 years, came out of a bunch of scientists recently and published in the New York Times. And, so that's a question of short-term, middle-term, long-term. What are we trying to hold on to, and why would we want to hold on to it? What are the arguments for it? The key with this play is it makes brings all of these things, in a sense, home without any easy answer as to where you should focus your energies.
So this is a, I'm going to call it a one-act play. It certainly brings together a diverse set of ideas, and the thread is this couple running through each of these different issues.
Right. There are actually several couples. There are two couples. There's a gay couple, Jaquan, who's a Black Lives Matter, a black man with a white boyfriend. There's an African-American woman, Shamika Davis, who runs the Frederick Douglass Bookstore in Harlem. There is Rita Dupree, whose son, 12-year-old son, she was a young mother, was recently killed by the police. And it's all of these collisions of stories that come together. And
yeah.
when you say it is a one-act play, but it is about 80 minutes, and it's a full play.
It's just one act
without an intermission. And
now,
it's
before
long.
We come to the third, I just want to give out the website, stanfordreptheatre.com. or the direct phone number, 650-725-5838. And this is the upcoming season. And let's go on to the third of these plays, Anna Considers Mars. And here we are now. We've got a young lady who wants to be on that first spaceship up to Mars. Is that how the story goes?
Yeah, that's basically it. As you probably know, Peter, there's a interest in Silicon Valley among some pretty weird people that the answer to the environmental problem is to send people to Mars and somehow colonize it, which makes about as much sense as a bunch of other things that are going on that don't make any sense, but there it is. And the idea here, though, is this girl is a young girl. Her mother took a video of her, a young girl in braces, who just wanted to go to Mars, like little kids dreamed of, you know, before there were astronauts and all that, or maybe they've just been astronauts. And so it ends up now, the time has changed, you know, the times have changed, and now this is actually a viable possibility, and so she joins a lottery of people who want to go to Mars, and she actually ends up being part of that group that goes. But the deeper issues are, is this escape real? Can you get away from the problems of at home and Earth? And some of these problems are very real. And she's also in the difficult business of raising funds to save uncharismatic species. So it's a lot of jokes about, you know, they're not like polar bears or whales or elephants that, you know, you can see, but they're ugly little slugs in the Amazon that are going to go extinct, and can you raise money to try to save them? And so this is part of her problem, is to try to do this. So she's looking at the long term, but then a certain possibility of escape arises.
So this is certainly a very rich, diversified season down there at Stanford. Voices of the Earth will take you back into nature, what the poets had to say, what the writers had to say, and also what Rachel Carson has to say. And then we move to a very different play, Polar Bears, Black Boys, and Prairie Fringed Orchids, which is a totally different story, a one-act play. And we close the season with Anna Considers Mars. The whole issue, we've got a man on the moon, do we want a woman on Mars? Or much deeper than that, why or how does a decision get made if you want to go exploring beyond this particular planet Earth? Now, to find out more about this, the website stanfordreptheatre.com or the phone number 650-725-5838. So let's have the last word from you, Rima. Also, thank you for coming in today.
Sure, Peter. Well, just quickly, the Stanford Repertory Theatre is in its 21st annual summer festival, and this summer we are joined in collaboration with Planet Earth Arts, and they are the group that commissioned the Polar Bears play and also Anna Considers Mars, and they and Playground and Planet Earth Arts are the producers of Anna Considers Mars, which just closed in San Francisco and had great review in the San Francisco Chronicle. So for those people who couldn't get to the city, come down and see that. And for those of you who haven't been to Stanford Repertory Theater, please come and see our Environmental and Social Justice Summer Festival.
Good. Welcome. Thank you.
Thanks you, Professor Rehm and Peter Robinson, for that. And a reminder that there are a number of films also associated with the festival. StanfordRepTheater.com for more information. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. A reminder that the shows are archived at KALW.org. You can send me a message, david@KALW.org, if you've got a show segment suggestion. My thanks to Niels Swinkels for producing. Among my guests next week, you'll learn about the wonderful semi-stage production of Ravel's L'Enfant et les Sortilèges at San Francisco Symphony, and about this year's San Francisco Mime Troupe production. Do tune in.